When I'd served as DIA director, I'd found many occasions to speak truth to power. I'd testified honestly about how reaping the peace dividend was undermining our workforce. I'd briefed Congress and the Secretary about our lack of confidence in what would happen to the Soviet nuclear capability with the breakup of the USSR. I'd delivered a lot of bad news, a lot of assessments, and a lot of my own personal judgments that those listening probably would have preferred not to have heard. But since taking the helm at NGA, I'd found that I was even less inhibited than I'd been as a 3-star general. To our credit, particularly Mike's, we didn't back down from the positions we'd expressed at the off-the-record session. But as a civilian agency director on what I knew, or thought, was my last hurrah in government, I was not as circumspect with my words. At that lunch, Mike and I both advocated establishing a strong DNI rather than creating a weak figurehead that would diffuse or confuse authority, and we told the Secretary that he should back legislation that would align the 3 national agencies under a DNI. The agencies could still fulfill their combat support responsibilities, but they would produce better intelligence under an authority whose full-time focus would be on integrating their work. We appealed to him to support improving how intelligence functioned, rather than protecting the existing bureaucracy. Secretary Rumsfeld cut short the lunch and left, missing a good dessert. Mike would later say that my discourse that day was the reason my NGA directorship was ultimately terminated early. Not completely, but I certainly believe it put me on Rumsfeld's and Cambone's watch list. I stuck around for almost another 2 years and later learned the final impetus for my dismissal was much more petty. On September 23, 2004, Senator Collins introduced her committee's legislation to create a strong director of national intelligence with clear authorities. The Senate bill passed on October 6th, and the far weaker House bill on October 16th. When the two chambers couldn't reconcile differences before adjourning for the November 2nd election, most observers assumed the bill was dead. Post-election lame duck sessions rarely pass any meaningful legislation, and the House and Senate were still far apart, with the House in a much stronger position because the Senate really wanted to pass the bill, and the House would have been happy to let it die. That enabled Duncan Hunter and his committee to extort whatever concessions Rumsfeld wanted under the rubric of compromise. If they didn't get what they demanded, the new Congress would have to start over with new legislation in January, and for opponents of a strong DNI, that was all to the good. That seemed the likely course, until someone creatively inserted the word abrogate. The House agreed to pass the bill if the Senate would consent to add Section 1018, which read, "The President shall issue guidelines to ensure the effective implementation and execution within the executive branch of the authorities granted to the Director of National Intelligence by this title and the amendments made by this title, in a manner that respects and does not abrogate the statutory responsibilities of the heads of the departments of the United States government." This essentially neutered the entire legislation by stipulating that anything the DNI asked an intelligence component to do could be overruled by the cabinet secretary who controlled that component, but this was the final offer. Collins and Lieberman realized that their choice was either to accept it or start over. The Senate acquiesced, and Congress passed the bill to the president, who signed the Intelligence Reform and Terrorism Prevention Act of 2004 into law on December 17th. IRTPA, like all major legislation, was flawed. Actually, with the addition of Section 1018, it overachieved at being flawed, but it did manage to codify intelligence reforms and establish in statute the Office of the Director of National Intelligence. Unsurprisingly, considering the Act's weak legislative charter, President Bush encountered difficulty in finding someone willing to serve as the first DNI. Bob Gates has written about how he turned the job down as he believed that the position involved huge responsibility but granted little authority to make anything happen. I remember thinking it was a job I certainly wouldn't want. In April 2005, John Negroponte, a distinguished State Department diplomat who'd been an intelligence customer his entire career but never an intelligence officer, took the oath of office as the first DNI. I like and respect John and appreciated his taking on this challenge, but I thought the position should have been filled by a career intelligence officer, someone steeped in intelligence culture, particularly as the first incumbent. In fairness, I would never advocate that a career intelligence officer lead the State Department. I was heartened by one of the first decisions John made, bringing Mike Hayden from NSA to be the principal deputy DNI. Mike pinned on his fourth star, the only four-star intelligence officer at the time, and became John's close partner in leading the IC. John and Mike set to work, bureaucratically outgunned by Rumsfeld and the large office of the Secretary of Defense. The DNI had a tiny staff scattered among a few offices in the new executive office building near the White House and in CIA headquarters. I heard about meetings where the four deputy DNIs crowded into the chief of staff's office. Two sat in chairs that got hit whenever the door opened, a third sat on a safe, and the fourth leaned on the doorframe. That was how the senior brain trust for the U.S. intelligence community was initially accommodated. John, to his credit, persevered through a very difficult launch. My immediate concerns for NGA were more parochial and more practical. Congress and the president had authorized DOD to close military bases around the world to reduce operating costs, and the Pentagon's recommendations to the Base Realignment and Closure Commission were due May 13, 2005, to include how it would allocate funding for new facilities. In January 2004, Secretary Rumsfeld had asked all installation commanders to begin to gather information and data. We were far ahead of the curve, having already studied how to consolidate NEMA's miscellaneous facilities in my first year on the job. By the time the commission activated, the decrepit NPIC building in the Washington Navy Yard in southeast Washington was nearly closed, and we had identified a site in Springfield, Virginia, to build NGA's future headquarters that, sometime after 2010, would bring together the two-thirds of the agency workforce in the Washington area. We just needed the Commission and Armed Services Committees to authorize us to spend $2.4 billion to build the new headquarters, as well as a smaller new facility near St. Louis. We'd calculated how, over time, the cost of this construction would be amortized, and we'd convinced DOD we'd save money from the initial investment. On Thursday, May 12th, with a day to go before deadline, the Secretary of Defense still had not finalized the list of bases selected for closure or realignment, and there was a scramble across DOD for each service and agency to protect its equities. That morning, Cambone told NGA he'd decided unilaterally that we couldn't put the money Congress had previously allocated for us to relocate NPIC toward construction of a new facility, so we didn't have enough to build a new headquarters. I spent most of the day on a series of tense phone calls with Cambone, Mike Hayden, and Pentagon Logistics Chief Mike Wynn, who was responsible for finalizing recommendations for the Secretary. In the space of 2 hours, the funding pendulum for NGA swung from zero to $2.4 billion for both new facilities, before settling on $2.1 billion for just the headquarters building in the east. At the end of the day, I felt I had another strike against me on Cambone's ledger, but I also felt it was well worth it. Then, on August 29, 2005, NGA and the nation suddenly faced a new kind of challenge. At 6:10 a.m. local time, Hurricane Katrina leveled miles of Mississippi and Louisiana coastline and left large sections of New Orleans underwater. In the aftermath, the Coast Guard Commandant and Chief of Hurricane Relief Operations, Admiral Thad Allen, reached out to NGA for help in assessing the magnitude of damage to the city. how it had affected the waterways, blocked the ports, and disrupted the infrastructure, including knocking out all communications into or out of much of Louisiana and Mississippi. Plainly stated, he asked us to help him acquire the situational awareness he needed to manage disaster response and prioritize relief efforts. NGA felt a special connection to New Orleans, since we had a small number of employees who lived in the affected area, and because we'd held GEOINTEL 2003 and GEOINT 2004 in the city. We deployed two Humvees adapted to establish communications and 75 people with GEOINT workstations. They created new maps and charts from aircraft and satellite imagery and produced analysis that was critical to helping THAAD determine the quickest ways to restore phone systems and other critical infrastructure and to map passage in and out of damaged neighborhoods. We even helped with tracking derelict oil rigs that had broken loose and were adrift in the Gulf of Mexico. The Coast Guard and NGA ended up working closely together, and I believe we saved lives and helped put the region on the path to recovery. We responded to an urgent request for help with the resources we had available, and that was my apparent undoing as NGA director. In the immediate days after the storm struck, the White House convened daily interagency meetings to review the government's response. I was told later that the Coast Guard and NGA were consistently singled out as exemplars for the federal response to Katrina. Secretary Rumsfeld wasn't aware that NGA had deployed so many people and assets, and that was the final straw. In September, I received a one-line memo from Rumsfeld that simply read, "You are relieved of duties as NGA director as of 13 June 2006. That was still 9 months away, but it was 3 months short of my planned and announced departure date of September 13th, and everyone would know my five-year tour had been cut short. Having essentially been fired, I'd be a lame duck for the remainder of my tenure. I called Tish Long, who was by then a senior executive in Steve Cambone's office, and asked if she knew anything about Rumsfeld's decision. She didn't, but gave me Cambone's personal cell phone number. I called him and asked for an explanation I could share with the workforce and with my family. He replied, "I can't tell you." I said, "Thanks a lot," and the conversation ended. The decision was never officially explained to me, although someone in Rumsfeld's office, whom I trust, later told me it was because we'd supported Katrina operations without first asking for permission. I didn't do so because we were complying with a long-standing written agreement with the Federal Emergency Management Agency, already approved by DOD, to respond automatically to requests for support in the event of natural disasters. In the intervening weeks, I began to realize that, aside from the public humiliation, expelling me on June 13th instead of September 13th meant that I would be 3 months short of being vested in a very small government retirement annuity. Again, Sue was not amused. Joanne Isham came to my rescue, arranging to enroll me in a 90-day CIA course designed to help career employees transition to the civilian world, which would extend my time in service to precisely 5 years. Cambone approved the training course under the condition that I not show my face around NGA after June 13th. One postscript on the Katrina episode. In the process of working with the Coast Guard, I got to know THAAD Allen pretty well professionally. After he learned about the circumstances of my premature departure, he brought me to his headquarters and presented me with the Coast Guard Distinguished Public Service Award. The Coast Guard had adopted me as something of an unofficial mascot, and it was a status that served me well for another decade and more. Some of the most personally gratifying experiences I had as DNI were at Coast Guard facilities and ships, where I always received a family welcome. In 2015, Sue and I had dinner with THAAD and his wife, Pam. As old war horses are wont to do, we reminisced as he showed us around his house. He recalled the superb work NGA did after Hurricanes Rita and Katrina, as well as in the aftermath of the BP oil spill, And I found that he still displayed a three-dimensional topographical map of New Orleans that NGA gave him when he retired. Katrina was a watershed moment for the intelligence community, and particularly for NGA. In the years that followed, NGA would put its tradecraft to work on natural disaster recovery efforts around the world, as well as in response to the Ebola outbreak in West Africa in 2014. Today, GEOINT is a tremendous force for good in the world, making positive impacts that extend beyond the dimensions of its intelligence mission. On my final day as director, the people of NGA made sure I felt their respect and affection as they wished me farewell. Lacking an auditorium, they set up a massive air-conditioned tent to accommodate the ceremony and reception and invited foreign partners and dignitaries, and we celebrated what we'd become. Not mappers and imagery analysts, but geospatial intelligence professionals. Leaving NGA in the summer of 2006, I had a much better idea of what the corporate world offered and quickly found work at a company called Detica. My connection was Denny Reimer, the former Army Chief of Staff whom I'd served with in Korea 20 years earlier. I'd determined by this point that I both could and would find my psychic income somewhere outside the contracting world. I had absolutely no intent to ever go back to government service, but found another outlet when Georgetown University hired me as their distinguished professor in the practice of intelligence, a title that sounds far more impressive than I deserved. I taught just one course a semester, a lecture and discussion class for graduate students. An interesting mix of recent Georgetown graduates and older intelligence professionals who were going back to school for their master's degree. I found that neither category of student took anything for granted, and so I struggled to stay one class ahead of these very bright students. I was very fortunate to have a postgraduate assistant assigned to help me with designing the curriculum, selecting readings, and anticipating the academic discussions that would follow. Hannah Powell was a recent master's program graduate who had studied in Spain and completed two internships with the State Department at embassies overseas. She was savvy in the ways of the academic world, Washington, and international diplomacy, and as it turned out, I needed her for all three. Occasionally after class, I met a few students at the Tombs, a famous Georgetown watering hole, to discuss world events and issues with which they were dealing. I enjoyed mentoring my students at least as much as I enjoyed teaching, and it was a lot less stressful to consider world events through an academic lens. On October 9th, North Korea conducted its first underground nuclear test. I'm sure I described to students how AFTAC would be scrambling to identify how large a detonation had occurred and how successful it was. Happily, I felt far removed from the action. In early November, President Bush announced that he was replacing Don Rumsfeld with Bob Gates, of all people, as Secretary of Defense. I told my students that appointing Gates was a great move for the nation, as he had been a tremendous DCI and had a great understanding of how the national security apparatus worked. I also read between the lines of Bob's public statements that he didn't want to leave as president of Texas A&M, but was answering the call out of a sense of duty to the nation. In conversations in the Tombs, I said I didn't envy Bob's having to go through the confirmation process, with its onerous volumes of paperwork on personal finances, intrusive written questions from Congress, and preparation for a confirmation hearing. I said I'd never want to go through any of that again. A few weeks later, Bob called to ask if I'd consider finishing out the Bush administration's term with him as his Undersecretary of Defense for Intelligence. I could feel the schadenfreude inherent in being asked to replace Steve Cambone as USDI. But I also knew the job wasn't easy, and I'd have to go through confirmation. Still, it was a chance to serve again, and I'd be working for someone whom I admired and respected greatly, and whom I considered a mentor. I told Bob I was interested, but that I'd have to talk to Sue, a conversation I correctly surmised would not go well. "How can you go back to work for this administration?" she asked that night. "They just fired you. When I replied, "But it's Bob Gates," she only repeated, "They just fired you." A few nights later, I met Bob for dinner at the Willard Hotel. There was no big wooing involved. He asked if I'd take the job, and I said yes. When he asked if there was anything he could do to help me, I told him, "It would really help if you called my wife." He laughed and said he would, and we then got to business. He explained that he wanted someone he knew and trusted to end the abject bureaucratic warfare between the Pentagon and the relatively new office of the DNI. He felt, with Mike Hayden as the new CIA director and me as USDI, we would have a team that trusted each other and could work together. He also wanted me to rein in the Pentagon's human intelligence apparatus, which had grown up under Rumsfeld and Cambone, and to cede proper authority back to the CIA. We ended up closing the restaurant down after a lengthy conversation about how to heal wounds and patch the divide between DOD and the intelligence community. Bob was good to his word. He called Sue to ask her leave to borrow me for a while. According to Sue, the conversation ran something like this. "Hi, Sue. This is Bob Gates. I know who you are. I was told I had to get your permission for Jim to come back to government. That sounds right. I promise I only want him through the end of the administration, less than 2 years once he's confirmed." "Okay, you can have him." Bob's version of the conversation paints Sue in a more gracious light than her own version. But either way, the result was that I was cleared to proceed. Bob was confirmed by the Senate and took office in December 2006. I set to work researching and completing financial disclosure questionnaires and 83 questions on topics ranging from my understanding of how detainees should be treated under Common Article 3 of the Geneva Conventions to my opinion of the organizational structure of both Defense Intelligence and the Office of the DNI. All except the final four were essay questions. Each of the last four asked for my agreement to testify and to provide documents to congressional committees if asked. If I provided any answer other than yes, I wouldn't have had to worry about showing up for a confirmation hearing. Again, because of politics beyond my control, my hearing was delayed until March 27th, but things seemed to be going smoothly until about 2 weeks before I was scheduled to testify, when I got a call from the White House personnel office. They wanted to know why I'd spent $80,000 on my NGA farewell reception the previous summer. I had no idea what they were talking about. I was certain there had been an error somewhere, and called NGA. The error, as it happened, was mine, in not asking the perfect question. While I had noticed the large tent, with its air conditioning, hard flooring, and wood-paneled Don's John's porta-potties, going up during my last days as director, I'd failed to ask, "How much does that tent cost?" 9 months too late to do anything about it, I learned the answer was $80,000. No one had run the cost estimate past me. The staff had just asked me whom to invite. But 3 weeks before my confirmation hearing, two disgruntled NGA employees had sent an anonymous letter detailing the tent rental charges to the Senate Armed Services Committee, which had in turn contacted the White House. We very quickly checked all the paperwork and accounting, and NGA had jumped through all the required legal hoops and received approval from the appropriate offices in the Pentagon before ordering the tent. They'd spent a lot of money to celebrate my 4 years and 9 months at the helm of the agency, but they'd done it by the book. After that drama, my hearing was relatively quick and painless. Senator John Warner, the ranking Republican on the committee, was my sponsor and graciously introduced me. Senator Carl Levin, as committee chair and senior Democrat, was enamored of everything Bob Gates was doing in the post-Rumsfeld era, and so, with my family in attendance, I received warm bipartisan support. After the hearing, the two senior senators invited me to a private anteroom, where they took me to the woodshed over the tent rental. I took responsibility and walked them through the approval procedures that NGA had gone through. They thought that level of spending was ridiculous and vowed to conduct an investigation into how much farewell ceremonies cost throughout DOD. I can only imagine what they would have found if they'd put that vow into action. In any event, the committee approved my nomination and sent it to the full Senate for a vote. We thought I might be confirmed on Thursday, March 29th, before the Senate adjourned for their Easter recess on April 8th. But by my Thursday evening class at Georgetown, I still had no word on the Senate vote. When I gave the class a break at the midway point, I had a voicemail from Jack Dempsey, USDI's legislative liaison officer, and Joan's husband, by the way. He said that some unknown senator had put my nomination on hold, and there was nothing anyone could do as the Senate had gone on recess. A few days later, Gates's legislative affairs office called to say that Senator Jim Bunning of Kentucky, the former Major League Baseball star, had placed the hold on me and asked what my connection to Bunning was. I had no idea, as I'd never worked with his office, never appeared before him for testimony, and never even met him. We were all mystified. Hannah Powell ended up saving me from the pain of an extended hold. Online, she discovered that Senator Bunning had put a similar hold on Art Money's nomination for Assistant Secretary of Defense in 1999, and didn't lift it until DOD agreed to buy a large quantity of electromechanical safe locks from Mass Hamilton Group, a company based in his home state of Kentucky. Sure enough, the lock contract was expiring, and Bunning wanted it renewed. Hannah quietly forwarded links to the news articles from 1999 to the Washington Post, which contacted Bunning's office. Returning from Easter break, his office quickly removed the hold on my nomination and denied ever having issued it in the first place. The Senate went back into session Tuesday and voted to approve my appointment on Wednesday, April 11th. Gates, who'd had enough, told me to bring Sue and any other family I could find, which ended up being just my two oldest grandkids, to his office, where he promptly swore me in that afternoon. This is how things work in Washington. Sue made a point of presenting me with an electronic countdown clock that would tick off the days, hours, and minutes until January 20th, 2009. The end of George Bush's presidency, when I would rejoin her in the land of luxury cruises. She intended it to have a place on my desk where I could keep an attentive eye on it. A few weeks later, Andy gave me a less serious gift, Jim Bunning's baseball card, which likely had been hard to come by. He suggested I get it autographed the next time I was on Capitol Hill. I never asked Bunning to sign it, but I kept the card, and the story lives on as a family joke. As soon as I was sworn in, Gates confirmed my marching orders: get Pentagon intelligence back in line and fix the relationship with the DNI. He then pretty much left me on my own, as he focused on winning the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. The equation for meeting his expectations had changed a bit during my confirmation process, and all for the better. In February, John Negroponte had stepped down as DNI, returning to the State Department as Deputy Secretary, and was succeeded by Mike McConnell. Mike and I had first worked together in the late 1980s, when I'd been the Senior Intelligence Officer for U.S. Pacific Command and Mike for U.S. Pacific Fleet, the Navy's service component in Pacific Command's area of operations. Later, of course, Mike had served as NSA director when I'd been DIA director, and Bob Gates, CIA director, and Mike had also been a partner at Booz Allen Hamilton when I'd been hired. My first order of business as USDI was to address the combative relationship between the office of the DNI and the office of the Secretary of Defense, and we immediately found a target of opportunity. The 2004 IRTPA legislation, in addition to creating the DNI, made it a requirement that to become eligible for promotion to senior executive, all intelligence officers get broader IC experience by serving outside their home intelligence element. One of the bureaucratic fights between ODNI and OSD had been over who had the authority to certify someone from a DOD agency or military service as having met that joint duty requirement. The whole matter was a little silly, putting bureaucratic infighting ahead of the welfare of employees, but it also gave me an idea. I proposed to Bob that I be assigned a dual-hat position on Mike McConnell's staff as the DNI's Director of Defense Intelligence, putting me on both Mike's and Bob's staffs. Bob supported the idea, and Mike was also on board. We signed a memo to create the new position on May 28th, just 47 days after Bob swore me in, which has to be some sort of DOD staffing record. Shortly after, Mike and I began an exchange of hostages, wherein he sent a representative to my staff meetings, and I sent Linda Petrone to his, one of the notable intelligence officers who'd worked with Joan Dempsey at DIA. Simultaneous to making peace with ODNI, I began examining the infrastructure of questionable human intelligence capabilities that had developed on the secretary's staff. Before he'd taken the job, Bob had said publicly that he intended to get DOD out of CIA's business. Representative Duncan Hunter, who'd worked to make sure IRTPA didn't abrogate any authority from the Secretary of Defense to the DNI, insinuated before, during, and after Gates's hearing that Bob would change his mind about giving up that power and leverage once he took office. When Bob stood firm, congressional Republicans were at first dismayed and eventually apoplectic, raging at both Bob and me for killing off what they considered to be critical DOD assets. Frankly, I didn't think it was appropriate to be operating any intelligence collection or analysis capability on the bureaucratic OSD staff. My personal responsibilities meant I had to focus on policy issues and budget, not on whatever was happening that day in Syria or North Korea. Moreover, some of the new capabilities that had arisen in DOD were redundant with those handled elsewhere in the community, namely at CIA. And following Bob's lead, I was more interested in making the IC work than accumulating power. By the time I moved into my Pentagon office, the IC had settled at 17 distinct elements. Of those, only 5 were intelligence agencies, with the lion's share of their resources focused on conducting intelligence as their primary mission, except for a portion of CIA's budget allocated for covert action and NSA's responsibilities for assuring the government's ability to communicate. Those 5 agencies were responsible for conducting national intelligence to keep the warfighters, the national security structure, and the president informed, and each agency had its specialty. CIA, human intelligence and covert operations. NSA, signals intelligence and cyber. NGA, geospatial intelligence. DIA, military intelligence. And NRO, building, buying, launching, and flying reconnaissance systems in space. 11 of the other intelligence community members were smaller offices responsible for supporting their parent organizations. The 4 DOD service intelligence elements mostly served their respective military service, Army, Navy, Air Force, and Marine Corps. 4 other elements directly served cabinet departments and secretaries, State, Treasury, Energy, and Homeland Security. And 3 other elements served large organizations within 2 other cabinet departments, the Coast Guard within DHS, and the Drug Enforcement Administration and the FBI, within the Justice Department. The intelligence component of the FBI is a bit of an anomaly, as it is closer in scale to an actual agency, with a significant focus on counterterrorism, counterintelligence, and cybersecurity. The FBI occupies a unique position, looking outward at threats beyond our borders, like the Big 5 agencies, and inward at domestic threats, with 1 foot in each of the worlds of intelligence and law enforcement. The final IC element was the office of the DNI. The ODNI was and is relatively small, particularly compared to the sprawling office of the Secretary of Defense and the Joint Chiefs of Staff, But the ODNI wasn't solely dedicated to coordinating budget and resources, as the USDI staff was. More than half of ODNI's staff of fewer than 2,000 people was and is focused on operational missions through their cross-community centers. The National Counterterrorism Center, NCTC, the National Counterproliferation Center, NCPC, Countering the Spread of Weapons of Mass Destruction, and the Office of the National Counterintelligence Executive, ONCIX, later renamed the National Counterintelligence and Security Center, NCSC, monitoring other nations' efforts to spy on us. In 2007, the ODNI added the Intelligence Advanced Research Projects Activity, IARPA, to conduct technology research for cross-community missions. In addition, the President's Daily Brief staff and the National Intelligence Council, which generates high-level community analytic products, including national intelligence estimates, work for the DNI. While ODNI operates as a default headquarters for the intelligence community, I came to consider it an active participant in the intelligence process and properly the 17th IC member. Years later, when I was DNI, our social media manager, Michael Thomas, succinctly summed up how the rest of the world views the ODNI. If the CIA is the New York Yankees, we're the commissioner's office. We don't have any fans, and no one buys our jerseys. As USDI, I was afforded access to the president's daily brief for the first time in my career, and the best part of that access was my conversation each day with my assigned briefer. I still value the relationships I've had with those individuals over the years. My primary job under the 2003 legislation that created USDI was making sure DOD intelligence components had the resources to operate, a task made easier by the fact that we were at war. As the fighting in Iraq and Afghanistan continued, and we uncovered terrorist networks and plans to attack in the United States and Europe, every year we asked for an increase in funding for the military intelligence program. And every year we got it. Much more difficult and controversial was granting authority. One of Bob Gates's stated reasons for declining the DNI position had been the director's lack of influence in hiring and firing IC component heads. Going completely against the Washington mantra of "where you stand is where you sit," Bob still felt the DNI should have at least some say over who led the IC agencies. We couldn't give the DNI direct hiring authority without changing the IRTPA legislation, and Congress was having a hard enough time just passing a budget. So Bob, Mike, and I set out to remedy the situation as best we could, focusing on Executive Order 12333, pronounced by everyone as 12333. President Reagan had signed this landmark executive order in 1981 as an underpinning for the organization, mission, authorities, and limits imposed on the IC. President Bush had last amended it in 2004, before IRTPA created the DNI. As a consequence, the executive order no longer comported with the spirit and intent of the law. Bob and Mike got White House approval to amend the executive order again, and I worked with David Shedd, one of Mike's four deputy DNIs, to draft and coordinate new language with the White House. Our most significant proposed change was to stipulate that the Secretary of Defense coordinate with and receive the concurrence of the DNI to hire and fire directors of the four DOD agencies. For the military service intelligence chiefs, the respective secretaries were required to consult with the DNI. Only in the government is the distinction between the words consult and coordinate so important. The changes also gave the DNI authority to set IC collection and analysis priorities and to coordinate areas of responsibility. President Bush signed the revisions on July 30, 2008, and the next day, Mike McConnell and I went to Capitol Hill to brief the House Intelligence Committee. In one of the most childish displays I ever saw on Capitol Hill, and that's saying a lot, Committee Ranking Member Pete Hoekstra stood up and led four Republicans out of the hearing room in protest over the fact that we'd changed an executive order, without their concurrence. What made the display so absurd is that Mike and I were representing a Republican administration, briefing them on an executive order being revised by a Republican president. I doubted the same thing had happened when President Reagan signed the original order in 1981. I found that my best work as USDI relied less on the authorities I had and more on the fact that I'd been around the intelligence business long enough to be acquainted with everyone involved. I'd met Lieutenant General Keith Alexander, the NSA director, when he was an up-and-coming Army major in the 1980s. Vice Admiral Bob Moret had succeeded me at NGA, and we'd kept in contact. I'd known Lieutenant General Ron Burgess at DIA since he'd served as the senior intelligence officer for Southern Command, starting in 1999. And Scott Large and I got to know each other as we sorted through NRO's major systems acquisitions. One of the other relationships that was invaluable was with Mike Vickers, who had a lengthy correspondence signature block as Assistant Secretary of Defense for Special Operations / Low-Intensity Conflict and Interdependent Capabilities. Basically, he conducted policy oversight for special operations forces and for military activities that were more spooky than regular warfare, a large and growing field of work in both Afghanistan and Iraq. He also served as a networker among the special operations community, CIA, and the Secretary of Defense. Mike was uniquely qualified for this role, as he'd served behind the scenes in the CIA's effort in the 1980s to arm and finance the Mujahideen in Afghanistan to resist and eventually overthrow the Soviet occupation. Mike was a featured character in Charlie Wilson's War, both the book and movie, and he was a legend among both intelligence officers and special operators. Mike and I spent many hours bonding in adjacent witness chairs in congressional hearings, and we traveled together a lot. One of the more interesting experiences of my career was going to Afghanistan with him in June 2009, visiting his old haunts as he narrated what had occurred in each place. I got a guided tour of the most successful covert action in history from a legendary figure who played a crucial role in making it all happen, who was also a great friend. I struggled to chronicle everything we saw, heard, and discussed as we hit stops in multiple countries, and I took pages and pages of notes. When I got back to the office, I always found holes in my trip report, things I only vaguely remembered doing. Mike carried only a single 3x5-inch card on which he took teeny-tiny notes, which he managed to turn into complete and readable, novel-length reports that included every detail of our visits. I still don't know how he did that. Years later, when I was DNI, Mike and his wife, Milana, invited Sue and me over to their house to watch Charlie Wilson's War. Mike kept pausing the movie, sometimes to debunk what was happening on screen, and sometimes to elaborate and embellish. In the film, Mike's character is introduced to the audience, and to Tom Hanks playing Representative Charlie Wilson, as the nerdy-looking kid in a white shirt, who was playing chess against four guys simultaneously. One thing I learned while watching Charlie Wilson's War at Mike's house is that the real Mike Vickers doesn't play chess. On November 4, 2008, Barack Obama was elected to be our 44th president. He had run on a campaign of hope and change, and in large measure on not being George W. Bush. He was young and charismatic, and his father was black. I marveled on that day, and occasionally throughout his presidency, at just how far America had come in my lifetime. It was a tremendous milestone for our nation, and one I was very proud of us for. At the same time, I knew only a few months remained for me to cement the progress we'd made in defense intelligence before someone else took the job of USDI. Of course, neither Bob nor his senior intelligence advisor, me, expected President-elect Obama to stage a covert meeting in a hangar at Reagan National Airport to ask Bob to stay on as Secretary of Defense. During the first week of December, I was in Wellington, New Zealand, on yet another farewell trip. Having previously bid farewell to my Aussie and Kiwi counterparts as DIA director and as NGA director, I was getting pretty good at it. Then on December 5th, I got word via official communications channels that Bob was going to call me. I figured he wanted to thank me for my service, which would be the nice way of saying I was to be replaced. That shouldn't have been an urgent matter, but Bob phoned at 9:30 a.m. on Friday in Washington, 2:30 a.m. on Saturday in New Zealand. He informed me he was staying on as secretary and wanted me to continue as USDI, but was checking to make sure I'd agree to do so before he approached the president-elect's transition team. It took me a long few seconds to process his message, and I mumbled something about being honored that he'd asked me to stay and that he didn't need to check with Sue again. When I called Sue at a more reasonable hour, she was supportive, although she asked if the countdown clock she'd given me could be reset. In the following months, nearly all of the people I'd grown accustomed to working with turned their responsibilities over to successors. One choice of President Obama's that I found baffling was Leon Panetta to lead CIA. Panetta was a politician, a former representative, and President Clinton's White House chief of staff, and his taking charge of the agency tasked with conducting human intelligence and covert actions made little sense to me. Politicians had a very mixed track record as CIA directors, and I recalled the short and controversial tenure of Porter Goss, who'd preceded Mike Hayden. Fortunately, I was very wrong about Leon. He has a great touch with people, and he became one of the most beloved and revered directors the agency has ever had. President Obama's pick for DNI, retired four-star Navy Admiral Denny Blair, at least made sense to me, although I wondered if he was the right fit. The DNI job, like that of the USDI, had very little line authority and required gentle powers of persuasion among close associates. But going in, he didn't have close relationships with any of the agency directors. Denny reminded me a lot of Vice Admiral Noel Geiler, whose military assistant I'd been at NSA, as he cut the same handsome, charismatic, articulate figure, and they had both finished their naval careers in the same demanding, high-profile job, commander of U.S. Pacific Command. Remembering the surprise I'd felt in 1991 when the civilians at DIA didn't necessarily move when I said jump, I wondered how someone who had distinguished himself in a career of military command would function in the culture of intelligence. Despite Gates, McConnell, Shedd, and my work revising EO 12333 the previous summer, the DNI still had very little real authority. My first interaction with Denny went a long way to alleviate my fears. He was amicable and interested in what I had to say, and as soon as he had grasped my dual-hat arrangement as Gates's USDI and as his Director of Defense Intelligence, he invited me to personally attend his senior staff meetings at ODNI headquarters, an offer on which I took him up. In the first few meetings, the ODNI staff was reluctant to bring up inside baseball issues in my presence, asking instead to discuss such matters privately. I, meanwhile, was very open about issues in DOD, asking for help where I could get it, and the staff soon decided I wasn't there simply to spy on them and began to open up. A new wrinkle on the national intelligence stage under President Obama was John Brennan's role as Deputy National Security Advisor for Homeland Security and Counterterrorism and Assistant to the President, another insufferably long title. John had been a career CIA officer and the first director of the National Counterterrorism Center, getting it up and running well before it was incorporated into ODNI in April 2005. People in Washington circles knew that President Obama had wanted John to be his CIA director, but being associated with the Bush CIA made confirmation difficult, and so John assumed a special advisory role in the White House. John and I weren't intimate friends, but we'd held each other in mutual respect for some years. As USDI, not involved with the substance of intelligence reporting, I didn't see much of John until the final year of my tenure. Fortunately, none of the DOD agency directors were up for replacement because of the transition. Unfortunately, Blair, Gates, and I had to make a hard call with respect to the National Reconnaissance Office leadership. NRO was going through a difficult period with a reorganization that didn't take and still suffering the after-effects of high-profile satellite system failures, notably the multi-billion-dollar Future Imagery Architecture program, which was canceled in 2005, and in 2008 lost control of a satellite that had to be destroyed in orbit. When the NRO director retired in April, we moved Betty Sapp, my USDI deputy for portfolio programs and resources, to NRO as the principal deputy director. She served as acting director until June, when we hired recently retired Air Force General Bruce Carlson. I didn't like losing Betty from my staff, but having someone with her technical experience and disciplined nature at NRO was a big plus, in addition to having someone there with whom I worked well and whom I trusted. With Bruce and Betty in the front office, NRO began to dig itself out of a hole. Then, in the summer of 2009, Lieutenant General Ron Burgess took seriously an idea of mine that other generals might have considered half-baked. As DIA director, he had the same responsibilities to fill senior defense intelligence jobs as I'd had way back when. While I'd once had to find a position for Brigadier General Select Mike Hayden, a problem easily resolved, Ron found that he had a gap in filling a critical post, specifically the senior intelligence job for the Joint Chiefs of Staff. None of the qualified two-star generals or admirals could leave their current positions, and moving one of them early would mean moving everyone early, to backfill one another in the resulting daisy chain. I suggested to Ron that he appoint a civilian, Robert Cardillo, DIA's Director of Analysis, to serve temporarily. Robert had spent most of his life as an analyst, but he'd been a great utility infielder for me at NGA, even running NGA's public affairs and congressional affairs shops. I assured Ron that Robert could handle coordinating intelligence for the JCS and briefing Chairman Mike Mullen. Of course, it required a leap of faith, since no civilian had ever held that position before. Happily, Robert filled the year-long gap successfully. Admiral Mullen had great regard for Robert and his work. Robert gained valuable experience that would be very useful to him, and to me, later, and Ron was able to bring Robert back to DIA as his deputy director in 2010, filling another critical vacancy. For 2.5 years, from April 2007 through November 2009, I managed to work in the trenches trying to strengthen both DOD and the IC and bringing both enterprises more closely together without drawing much public attention to my existence. But on November 5th, 2009, Army Major and practicing psychiatrist Dr. Nidal Hassan walked into a medical screening facility at Fort Hood, Texas, shouted, "Allahu Akbar," and began shooting, intentionally targeting soldiers in uniform over civilians and pursuing them as they fled the building. The rampage only ceased when Hassan stopped to change clips and civilian police sergeant Mark Todd took him down with return fire. 13 people had been killed and another 32 injured. From the White House, John Brennan tasked the DOD, FBI, and NCTC with conducting a joint investigation into how an active-duty, commissioned Army officer could become radicalized without the Army's knowing. The FBI's superb deputy director, John Pistole, and I dug into the evidence and started conducting interviews. A number of Hassan's co-workers testified that he was very upset about his impending deployment to Afghanistan, and others said he'd been torn about what he saw as a choice between the United States and Islam. We learned that Hassan had visited radical Islamist websites and expressed admiration for Anwar al-Awlaki, the radical Islamist imam who'd counseled 3 of the 9/11 hijackers from his mosque in Virginia and who, 8 years later in Yemen, was radicalizing and recruiting Western Muslims to the cause of al-Qaeda online. The FBI found 16 emails ranging from December 2008 to June 2009 between the two, almost all from Hassan to Awlaki. The content of a few of those emails was concerning, particularly Hassan's desire to see Awlaki again in the afterlife. Hassan had recently paid a visit to Guns Galore in nearby Killeen and asked for whichever handgun had the highest magazine capacity. He'd purchased the weapon the next day and then practiced firing it rapidly on a gun range until he was proficient. On December 9th, we held a press conference, and John told members of the media that Hassan had been in electronic communication with an FBI target. It didn't take the media long to figure out that it meant that Hassan had emailed Awlaki. In the months that followed, John and I answered a lot of questions from a lot of people, including in closed congressional hearings. As people sought to assign blame, I was continually reminded of Terry Schwalier and the Khobar Towers attack, and how hindsight is always 20/20. But as I was asked again and again why FBI or intelligence elements hadn't been reading Hassan's emails and monitoring his internet usage before his rampage, a new unsettling thought occurred to me. I wondered just how intrusive people wanted or expected us to be. Hassan was an American citizen, a commissioned officer in the army, and a psychiatrist. Did he give up his privacy rights or right to practice his religion when he became an active duty service member? When he visited radical sites online? The FBI determined they didn't have enough evidence to get a warrant for a search. Did Americans want their intelligence community to start monitoring citizens without a warrant? How many steps away from a Stasi-type environment were we? As we concluded our investigation and briefed executive and legislative branch leaders, I didn't find any satisfactory resolution to these unsettling questions. I still haven't. In the midst of struggling with the quandary of how to protect both public safety and individuals' right to privacy, I witnessed one of the most morally courageous acts I've ever seen. On January 27th, in his 2010 State of the Union address, President Obama announced his intent to repeal the Clinton-era Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy in DOD, thus allowing gay and lesbian service members to serve openly. Secretary Gates and JCS Chairman Mullen were called to testify on the proposed repeal 6 days later. In their opening statements, both spoke in support of the president's position, while cautioning that DOD needed time to study how the repeal would affect troops, particularly those deployed in war zones. This was the circumspect, reasoned, well-justified position of the department. At the conclusion of his opening statement, Mike said 6 words that always riveted my attention. Speaking for myself and myself only. Generals and admirals are expected to answer congressional questions candidly, giving their personal views when asked. In my experience, presenting both intelligence briefings and sworn testimony as a general officer and as a senior civilian, I had been very careful to differentiate between when I was speaking for the government and when I was breaking with the party line of the bureaucracy, the company policy, as I called it, knowing that expressing my personal views could influence decisions in ways for which my bosses and the institutions we represent may not have been prepared. For the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff to make any such remark, particularly planned and scripted in his opening statement, was of consequence. Pausing just a moment, Admiral Mullen addressed his personal views to Senator Carl Levin. Mr. Chairman, speaking for myself and myself only, it is my personal belief that allowing gays and lesbians to serve openly would be the right thing to do. No matter how I look at this issue, I cannot escape being troubled by the fact that we have in place a policy which forces young men and women to lie about who they are in order to defend their fellow citizens. For me, personally, it comes down to integrity, theirs as individuals and ours as an institution. For the 17 years since the imposition of the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy, no service chief had spoken publicly against the policy, and no service chief, much less a JCS chairman, had ever advocated for allowing gay service